from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, we talk with Bloomberg TV journalist Emily Chang about her new book, Brotopia, Breaking Up the Boys Club of Silicon Valley. The problem of sexism in the Valley is not new. Tech leaders have acknowledged it and say they're trying to address it. But in her book, Brotopia, Emily Chang goes deep and exposes some shocking ways that bro culture continues to play out, from sex parties and strip club lunches to investors taking meetings in hot tubs. Join us on Forum as we take another look at the industry whose workers and products profoundly shape our lives. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. In her new book, Brotopia, Bloomberg journalist Emily Chang digs into what she describes as Silicon Valley's boys' club atmosphere. Regular lunches at strip clubs, workplace harassment, elitism. She describes an industry that prides itself on its progressive politics, yet treats women with hostility. But Chang says it wasn't always this way. Women have historically made critical contributions to the field of computer science. And as more women have started speaking out and fighting back, Chang is more adamant the tech industry can and must change. Emily Chang is the host and executive producer of the daily TV show Bloomberg Technology, where she interviews top tech executives, investors, and entrepreneurs. Emily Chang, welcome to Forum.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here, and I appreciate you shining a light on this topic.
So tell me, how did you come up with Brotopia for the title?
Well, I know Brotopia makes a statement. To me, it perfectly encapsulates this idea of Silicon Valley as a modern utopia where anyone can change the world, anyone can make their own rules if they're a man. But if you're a woman, it's incomparably harder. And that shows in the numbers, and this is an industry that prides itself on data. So I just look at the data. Women hold 25% of computing jobs. They account for 7% of venture investors. These are the people who are deciding what gets to be the next Facebook. And women-led companies get just 2% of funding.
And you say that's
preposterous.
Yes, you say that's actually much worse than women's representation on Wall Street.
I can't tell you how many times as I was writing this book that people said to me, well, Silicon Valley can't possibly be worse than Wall Street. Well, in fact, it is. At the top banks on Wall Street, it's about 50-50 if you look across employee ranks. Wall Street has a lot of work to do when it comes to getting women into senior leadership positions. But in fact, it is far more equal than the numbers that we see in Silicon Valley. And there are a lot of theories about that, you know, but for an industry that prides itself on changing the world, you know, I do think there's an element of hypocrisy here. You know, not everyone has an equal chance, and at no stage of the game is everyone on a level playing field.
And there are some specific sort of daily occurrences that you point to that create what you've described as a toxic atmosphere, particularly for women. So you went to the Gold Club. Tell us what that is.
So the Gold Club is a strip club in SoMa, where there are a lot of startups in San Francisco. And at 11:45 a.m. on a Friday, I walked in and there was a line out the door. And, you know, most of the people in line, you could tell, were tech workers. And I sat down at a table. I had a colleague with me who agreed to accompany me on this dicey reporting excursion. And, you know, I spoke to one of the women working at the club, and I confessed immediately that I was a journalist and I was there to do some reporting. And she was very helpful. And she, you know, rattled off five or six companies, tech companies that, you know, workers routinely come in from. You know, they'll often come in groups, sometimes with their boss. They're talking about work. They'll go up to a private room together. This is in the middle of the day. And, you know, I spoke to a couple of female engineers at Uber, for example, who told me that they were routinely invited to strip clubs by their male managers in the middle of the day. And it put them in a really uncomfortable position. You know, do they go to the club? Are they part of the team where, you know, they're going to be talking about work? Maybe they decide who gets to work on the next project or launch the next special feature. Or do they not go and be part of the uncool kids club that stays behind.
And this is part of why you also pointed out that some drug-fueled, sex-fueled parties that sometimes are even on the company dime have an effect on the way that women are treated, in part because it's at strip clubs or at some of these parties where business gets done. So you wouldn't necessarily have an issue with some of these sort of freewheeling type of events if it wasn't that business actually gets done here and women are put in a bind.
Absolutely. You know, the Bay Area has long had a tradition of sexual exploration and sex positivity. And, you know, for many people who are exploring these open relationships, it can be a really fulfilling experience. You know, but unfortunately for women who have attended some of these parties and some of these social gatherings, they found that they're subject to a double standard. And they're a lot more about power than they are about sex or exploration. And that power dynamic is completely lopsided. And, you know, I spoke with dozens of men and women who have been part of the scene. And women entrepreneurs especially felt that they, you know, were sort of damned if they do, damned if they don't. If they attend these parties, they can be disrespected or discredited. And if they don't, they can be shut out of potential networking opportunities. And when we're talking about an industry where women are just getting 2% of funding, they're looking for anything they can to catch a break.
And so could you just give a little bit more of an example of how this can play out? I know you were describing one woman who went to one of these parties, and then when it came time for someone to make a contribution, they kind of came on to her about thinking that she was sort of sexually open, and it became this sense of, well, was this person just giving me this money because they were looking for a hookup?
So this was an official company party hosted by a venture capitalist and sponsored by a venture capital firm. And I never said this was a sex party in particular, but this is a party where we saw some disturbing aspects of behavior that sort of, you know, very obviously crossed a line. And, you know, I spoke to several people at this party who described drugs being taken and cuddling on the floor. And one woman in particular felt pressured into sexual activity. And, you know, to me, this is black and white. At a company-sponsored party, people should not be cuddling on the floor. And it put her and others who were there in a very uncomfortable position.
And the same is true with what you've also described as one venture capitalist who liked to have company pitches given to him in a hot tub.
You know, yes, that happened. You know, a particular investor, and, you know, he was talking to me about this on camera on my show, talking about how he hosted these amazing parties in the hot tub and how one of his entrepreneurs, which just so happened to be Travis Kalanick, the CEO of Uber at the time, had, you know, phenomenal staying power in the hot tub. He could sit in there for hours. And, you know, I went on to interview Katrina Lake, who is the CEO of Stitch Fix, you know, a really phenomenal female entrepreneur. And she said to me that she heard this same investor talking about these hot tub parties at a conference. And she said, in that moment, I'm thinking to myself, I am never going to get funding from this man who wants to sit in a hot tub and pitch investors a business in a bikini while holding a beer. And, you know, I think it goes to this idea of how business in Silicon Valley gets done. You know, a lot of business happens outside the office, whether it's the hot tub or the bar or the hotel lobby or the sidelines of a tech conference. And, you know, unfortunately, we found women being put in positions where, you know, they're not pitching their business. They're trying to defend themselves against sexual advances. And I can't tell you how many women I spoke with who would meet with investors, you know, at any time of day. And they thought it was a pitch meeting, and the investor seemed to think it was a date. And in an industry that is just so male-dominated, it's just very unfortunate.
Right. You say that it's just the very large numbers of men that kind of normalize this behavior so that it isn't really seen as making people uncomfortable or inappropriate. And then also in the setting of the Bay Area where we are more sexually free. But one of the things you point out is that it wasn't always this way and that it didn't have to be this way. Can you talk a little bit about when the basically the demographic shifted from women being a big part of computer engineering to then becoming much more men?
This was one of the most surprising things I found in my research. In the 40s and 50s, women actually played vital roles in the computing industry. They were well represented among software programmers. They were programming computers for the military and computers for NASA. Think Hidden Figures, but industry-wide. And then in the 60s and 70s, as the industry started to explode, companies were desperate for new talent. So a software company hired two psychologists to develop a personality profile to help them identify good programmers. And what they decided is that good programmers, quote, don't like people. Hmm. Well, if you look for people who don't like people, you'll hire far more men than women. That's what the research tells us. And there's also no evidence to suggest that people who don't like people are better at this job. But these tests were widely used for decades, and we're talking about companies like IBM using these tests, and solidified this stereotype of the antisocial, mostly white male programmer as the picture-perfect idea of who can do this job. That stereotype was repeated in movies. It was repeated by parents and teachers. And it had a grave impact on the simple numbers of women in computing. You know, women held 30-some percent of tech jobs in the 80s. That has plummeted to 25%. Women were getting 37% of computer science degrees in 1984. That has also plummeted now to 18%. And it's been flat for the last decade. And so, you know, I think about how the internet might be different if more women and people of all backgrounds who do like people were part of this industry from the start. Because, you know, we're talking about people who are making products for the world that are used by billions of people. And I think it's essential that the people making those products understand the people they're making the products for.
We're talking with Emily Chang. She is the host of Bloomberg Technology about her new book, Brotopia, Breaking Up the Boys Club of Silicon Valley. One of the things that you point out is that Google founders, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, that they did focus on hiring women early on. So what happened with that?
In the early days of Google, Larry and Sergey really wanted strong women on the team. And they hired people like Susan Wojcicki, who built the ad business, led the acquisition of YouTube, and is now the CEO of YouTube today. They hired Marissa Meyer, a young computer engineer who designed the minimalist user interface with that single search bar that we all use every day. And Sheryl Sandberg, who scaled the entire ad business and then went on to do it again at Facebook. But over time, as the company went public and was exploding in size, they simply lost focus on diversity as a priority. They were just trying to fill those seats as fast as possible. And when they lifted their heads up after the financial crisis, they realized there were no women. And Google's numbers today are no better than the industry average. And I think it just goes to this point that, you know, this isn't just the right thing to do. This is the smart thing to do. Hiring women is a good business decision. And I think a lot of these women didn't get enough credit for, you know, the success that Google became. And, you know, it also goes to show what can happen when you focus on it, when you prioritize it, and what happens when you don't.
So what are all the excuses then? I mean, you're saying that there is a way to focus on it, to prioritize it, and to, you know, to find some superstars like Sheryl Sandberg and Susan Wojcicki and Marissa Meyer. But what are the excuses you hear for why companies are unable to hire or recruit or retain more women?
The most common excuse is the pipeline problem. This is a reference to the number of women and incoming candidates who are studying computer science. And, you know, my argument is that the tech industry created the pipeline problem by creating this very narrow idea of who can do these jobs. Another excuse is, you know, the meritocracy excuse. People in Silicon Valley pride themselves on this idea that anyone can succeed here and change the world. But this idea that Silicon Valley is a meritocracy completely ignores the privilege at play for the winners and the discrimination and larger systemic factors working against everyone else. And in fact, when you believe that you are operating in a meritocracy, you can actually act more anti-meritocratic because you simply believe everyone got to where they are because they deserve to be there, when in fact the escalator is moving far faster for some than it is for others. And the last excuse is that women just don't want to be here, that they don't want these jobs, and it's simply not true. I interviewed 6 young women at the end of the book, teenagers who've all studied computer science, and they're so excited to be part of this industry and do their part to change the world. But they read the news, you know, they hear about what happened at Uber. They know that Sheryl Sandberg is, you know, the only Sheryl Sandberg, and there are very few women like her in this industry. And so what they see reflected in the Silicon Valley of today impacts them and their own belief in their ability to succeed here.
Do you ever hear the notion that, well, women have triumphed in tech, so it must not be all that bad, right? They were able to do it, as a reason, maybe as a justification for a meritocracy, or again, as an excuse?
Well, you know, some women have been able to triumph, but, you know, the vast majority of women haven't had a chance. And, you know, I think of all of the women who didn't look like Mark Zuckerberg and didn't look like Bill Gates, who never got a chance to start the next Facebook or the next Microsoft. I mean, there's an incredible amount of just pattern matching that goes on here, and investors looking for what they believe, you know, is the perfect entrepreneur, when in fact that idea of the perfect entrepreneur not only shuts out half the population, but, you know, people who do like people, essentially. And so, you know, one of the interesting exercises that I did towards the end of the book is I posed this question: what if women built the internet? How might the world be different? And I interviewed Twitter co-founder Evan Williams, who told me that he thinks if women had been on the founding team of Twitter early on, that online harassment and trolling wouldn't be such a problem. They weren't thinking about how Twitter could be used to send death threats or rape threats. They were thinking about wonderful and amazing things that could be done with Twitter. And to me, it's just a perfect example what could have been. You know, maybe online harassment and trolling wouldn't have been such a problem. Maybe porn wouldn't be so ubiquitous. Maybe video games wouldn't be so violent. Maybe we'd have better parental controls on all of these apps and games that our children are using. And we can't have decisions being made in the most powerful and influential industry in the world by 95% men.
And this is why you feel like the demographics, the lack of women, people of color as well, in the tech industry should matter to people who are outside of it as well.
Absolutely. Silicon Valley is changing our lives every day. And I think we take the people who are making these products for granted. We don't think about who's behind the scenes, but this is an industry that is controlling what we see and what we read, how we communicate and relate to each other, how we shop, how we get around. They're making the video games that our children are playing, the social media that they use. This is not just Silicon Valley's problem or a problem for people who want to work in Silicon Valley. This is everybody's problem. I mean, this is an industry that is affecting billions and billions of people everywhere and changing our culture. And so, you know, I have 3 sons, and I fully believe that their lives will be better in a more equal world, and that the products that we all use will be better if people of all backgrounds are making them. And I know that there are so many mothers and fathers out there who want their sons and daughters to succeed here, and their daughters won't stand a chance if something doesn't change.
The other thing that you remind me of is we interviewed Ellen Ullman about her. She has a long history in Silicon Valley, and she was also just talking about how influential personalities or people's experiences are in the algorithms that they create as engineers. It makes me wonder why those personality tests that found that antisocial people would be better at computer programming and engineering, why they were so widely influential. I mean, I understand that they influence the industry, but why were those theories adopted so broadly?
I think they were looking for a shortcut. I mean, this is the time when, you know, the tech industry was exploding and the Macintosh and Windows were coming on the scene, and the industry was full of this sort of heady excitement around what could be, and they needed to hire people as quickly as possible. And, you know, unfortunately, it's the same shortcut that is happening today. I mean, if you go inside these companies, they're much more concerned about getting through the next product launch or raising the next round than thinking about the long term. There's a lot more short-term thinking here. But the reality is nothing in Silicon Valley happens overnight, contrary to popular belief. I mean, it took Facebook 8 years to go public. Uber's been around for 9 years, and it is still not a public company. So I think these companies really need to think about how do we create a culture and environment and a work ethic that is sustainable over the long term.
Can you talk about your conversation with Peter Thiel, the PayPal founder? Because it gets at what I think you see as another real problem for why this issue has become so stubborn in Silicon Valley in terms of sexism and the lack of women. Describe that conversation with Peter Thiel.
Peter Thiel is one of the most prominent venture capitalists in the world. He was a co-founder of PayPal, and I interviewed him on stage at a conference in San Francisco. Keep in mind, this is a man who is investing in exploring the bounds of outer space and building floating communities on the ocean, and who, you know, is incredibly passionate about the future of nuclear energy and even believes that immortality is achievable. There are no limits to Peter Thiel's thinking, except apparently when it comes to women. I asked him, you know, why are women so underrepresented in tech? What did he think the problem really was? And he pointed out that there are very few female founders, very few female entrepreneurs of so-called unicorn companies. So these are companies that surpass $1 billion valuation. And he said, I think that's the real problem, but I don't know what to do about it. We're talking to one of the most, you know, forward-thinking and open-minded investors in the world. And when you ask him about what to do about women, he simply says, I don't know.
Yes.
It just goes to this idea that I believe that the people in Silicon Valley who are changing the world and taking us to Mars and building self-driving cars and connecting us to humans everywhere, that they can change this too. They can hire women and pay them fairly.
Yes, it gets at that frustration you have over what you feel like is the hypocrisy if you're going to claim to change the world, right? And put yourself in a position of a very high stature to some degree to have that kind of power and influence, then you should be able to address this issue as well and not give it a pass. We're talking with Emily Chang about what she sees as the toxic bro culture in Silicon Valley and how it shuts out women in one of the most powerful and lucrative industries in the world. Her book is called Brotopia, Breaking Up the Boys Club of Silicon Valley. And I want to open the phone lines and ask you, our audience, what's your experience? Do you feel like Brotopia is an accurate description for Silicon Valley? And if so, what do you think it will take to fix it? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. Email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us at @kqedforum, or find us on Facebook. I'm Mina Kim. More after the break. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Bloomberg TV journalist Emily Chang about what she calls the boys' club atmosphere of Silicon Valley. The tech industry's products have profoundly changed our lives, but behind the scenes, says Chang, the industry remains largely toxic to women. Her new book is called Brotopia, Breaking Up the Boys Club of Silicon Valley. And we've invited you, our listeners, to share with us whether you feel like this is an accurate description of Silicon Valley and whether you have thoughts on how to fix it, if so, or what your experience has been. And Liza tweets, I've been in those hot tubs. If you have the courage to harass back, men usually understand that you have entered the playing field and change their approach quickly. If we want equality, we have to act as aggressively as the men we complain about. And Janice says, I find this amusing in that the tech women's movement, the very movement that insists males and females have few biological differences, is upset when partying is done in sex clubs or sexually explicit venues. You can't have it both ways. Emily Chang, what do you think about that?
I do think that we need to think about how business is getting done in Silicon Valley and creating a more level playing field and more inclusive places. And, you know, if you're going to go to a strip club for lunch with your team, think about how that's going to affect your team. I mean, I hesitate to say anything draconian. Don't do this, don't do that, don't have happy hour. But I do think there just needs to be much more thoughtful consideration around how socializing and work intertwine. I interviewed Max Levchin, also a co-founder of PayPal, who is much more sort of forthright about the mistakes he made earlier in his career. And he said at PayPal, he admits he hired all his friends and they all happened to be men, and that shut out a lot of women. And at his next company, Slide, the culture got a little out of control and it was very bro-y, as he said. And at a certain point, he had to take a stand and ban alcohol and kick out a lot of the bros, as he said, and sort of do a cultural reset. Now that he's on his third company, he's very much aware of the mistakes he made in the past and willing to admit them and really focused on hiring and promoting women. And at first he banned happy hour, said no way is there going to be alcohol in the office, and then he sort of eased up on that edict slightly. I do think that there can be a happy medium, but you know, these are things that need to be, you know, constantly considered and thought out, because you know, the idea is to create an inclusive, healthy culture that can attract people of all backgrounds. We're not here for a frat party. And you know, I came into this as a journalist. I had no agenda. I'm just reporting the truth of what I saw. And I truly believe that we have to understand how and why we got here and what the problem really is before we can change it. And I do believe we can change it.
Well, can I get your reaction to Tesla CEO Elon Musk's comment to Wired about your description of some of these parties? He writes, she conflated what happens in SF sex clubs in the Tenderloin, which had been around long before Silicon Valley was anything, with boring VC parties on the peninsula. That's misleading to the public and she should be ashamed. What was your reaction? What's your response to that?
So, you know, if you go to a party and you talk to five different people, you'll get five different stories. And, you know, I reference, you know, a woman in particular who had an incredibly horrifying and uncomfortable experience at a VC-sponsored party where there were drugs, where there was cuddling, where she felt pressured into sexual activity. You know, I am reporting here on a broad spectrum of behavior that happens outside the office. And unfortunately, it's put women into a lot of uncomfortable positions. This is the kind of reporting that I simply couldn't make up. And of everything that I have reported, probably what shocked me the most.
Well, Ernst says, I went to a startup party a few years ago. I started talking to one of the women there and asked her what she did for the company. She said she'd been hired to be at the party. This was a small company of perhaps 10 employees, and they had not a single woman working there. It was appalling. Let's hear from Richard in San Francisco. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
Hi. What do you want to share?
Well, I have a daughter that not too long ago graduated from an Ivy League school, started out as a computer science major, and ended up a physics major, which is even more rare for a woman these days. And one of the things I thought was that hasn't been talked about is to go further back to the root of the problem, and that in these schools, and not just Ivy League, but across, it's the male-dominated teaching culture. I remember my daughter and her friends talking about the percentage of women that were in the freshman class that declared themselves computer science majors and how that had dropped precipitously by the time senior year came along. It was even worse in other sciences, but that the tenured teachers, the most senior teachers, the ones really kind of structuring and running the curriculum, the department, are male in most cases, and that there is therefore a culture that is not inviting to women. And so this idea that the pipeline isn't there starts further back.
So then, Richard, thanks for that. So then, Emily Chang, is there some truth to the pipeline when that is used by tech leaders to say, look, it's just too hard to find the women because, as Richard was saying, they are discouraged from, you know, becoming computer science majors?
Absolutely. There is a pipeline problem. You know, my argument is that the tech industry created a pipeline problem. And unfortunately, this stereotype of the antisocial white male nerd has been repeated, you know, in computer labs and in college classrooms. You know, I I tell the story of Marissa Meyer in the book, and you know, perhaps she experienced some of what your daughter experienced when she was studying computer science at Stanford. She one day opened the Stanford Daily newspaper and found a story about campus celebrities, or weirdos, as the article described, who stuck out. And one of the people in that article was, quote unquote, the blonde woman in the upper division computer science classes. And she read it and thought to herself, hey, I should know that woman. And then she realized, wait, they're talking about me. And, you know, for the first time, she felt like she was different and she was being singled out. And she realized that she was the only woman. But she had had this incredible luck over the course of her childhood and her studies, where no one ever told her that she stood out. No one ever remarked about how exceptional she was for being so good at math and science. And she made the point that, you know, sometimes when you tell young girls, oh, you're so good, and that's very unusual, it makes them feel even more like an imposter and gives them an excuse to drop out. So I absolutely do agree that there's a lot of work that teachers and parents have to do here to make sure that these stereotypes don't get reinforced. And there are some organizations like Code.org that are doing phenomenal work to retrain teachers to teach computer science, men and women, to sort of combat the problem that, you know, not only is the tech industry male dominated, but teachers and professors are also overwhelmingly male as well. That said, you know, the industry cannot simply blame the pipeline for all of the problems. There is so much work that these companies have to do to create more welcoming environments and to encourage people like your daughter to come to the industry and stay in the industry. And so, you know, I do have some really important stories in the book of what people here are working on. There are some CEOs who are doing some incredible work to hire and promote women. And what I would say to all the daughters out there, the young girls out there, is don't give up, because there are people doing great work to create strong and healthy company cultures. You just have to find them.
Well, let's go next to Elizabeth in Wisconsin. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
So I just wanted to share that I think the things that Emily is talking about, Silicon Valley, is not only pervasive there, but it's pervasive in the technology industry across the nation. I've worked in the technology industry in the Silicon Prairie in the Midwest, and I've experienced some of these very same things. I've actually had incidents in my career where I've been passed over in certain situations because I don't participate in some of the parties, some of the, you know, the brotopia, as you termed it, that's gone on in the organizations I've worked for, and have had higher qualifications, more experience than some of those individuals that have gotten promoted or put into those positions because they were participating in that culture. So it's definitely pervasive.
Well, Elizabeth, thanks for sharing your experience. And yet, Emily Chang, Diana says, your author sounds so full of it. I have no idea where she got her data, but the tech workers I know include men and women. They're working constantly and do not go to sex clubs or do anything else that your author discusses. This is just another attack on tech workers. Emily Chang, can you talk about Susan Fowler's blog post? Because I think you saw that as a real turning point, or maybe a tipping point is the way that you put it in your book, in terms of recognizing how pervasive the sexual harassment is.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is an industry that, you know, to your prior comment, that prides itself on data. And I just want to throw some more data out there, that women are twice as likely to quit a job in tech as men. And they're not leaving to go home and take care of their kids. They're actually 800% more likely to leave tech jobs than women are likely to leave jobs in other fields. And for the women who are leaving the tech workforce at such an alarming rate, they're not dropping out of the workforce. They're going to take jobs in other fields. And the reason that they cite is because of the hostile culture. Susan Fowler really set off a firestorm when she published a blog post about her experience at Uber. And she was propositioned for sex by her manager on her very first day on the job. And she took screenshots of it. This all happened over the company chat system. And when she brought it to HR, they said, we're going to let that slide because he's a high performer. And, you know, it is just shocking how much that kind of behavior has not been just tolerated, but normalized to sort of protect people who are these, you know, so-called brilliant jerks. And unfortunately, I think too many people like that have been given a pass. You know, a couple weeks after Susan Fowler wrote that blog post, I had 12 women over at my home who work in tech for dinner. And they're exhausted. They're tired. They're frustrated and fed up because they are so often the only woman in the room day after day, hour after hour. And yet, they love their jobs. They love doing their part to change the world. And the industry really needs to change to keep them here because, you know, as I said earlier, this is an industry that is making products that people everywhere use, and we need people of all backgrounds represented in building these products.
You focused on Susan Fowler as a tipping point, but I was wondering what you think the impact of the Ellen Powell trial was when she sued Kleiner Perkins for gender discrimination. I mean, she essentially did have to absorb a lot of attacks after she made that lawsuit, after she brought that lawsuit.
You know, I think the Me Too movement actually started in Silicon Valley, and it started with Ellen Powell. And as you say, in 2012, she sued her venture capital firm, Kleiner Perkins, for gender discrimination. And it was a really long and painful trial. And in 2015, she lost in court. But in a way, she won in the court of public opinion. And I don't think we would be sitting here talking about Susan Fowler and all of these stories if it hadn't been for Ellen Powell. She really started to pave the way for other women to come forward. And, you know, then this was long before President Trump got elected. And then Susan Fowler comes forward. And after Susan Fowler came forward, a number of female, most of them entrepreneurs, came forward about being harassed and propositioned and even assaulted by male investors. And this was long before Harvey Weinstein. So I think Silicon Valley has played an incredible role in this Me Too movement that has since exploded in Hollywood and exploded in Washington. And we're seeing sort of women everywhere summon this sort of collective courage. And for the first time, women are being listened to. And that's why I feel like this historical and cultural moment is such an opportunity to change.
Well, Sue says, I've been able to rise up the ranks largely shielded from this type of behavior. One thing I run into, though, is a credibility discount from men when in situations like fundraising or negotiating partnerships. Whenever I walk into a meeting, it feels like I'm walking into a rat's nest where the people at the other side of the table, always men, have such a leg up in terms of experience and information, and they know this. This exacerbates women's feelings of imposter syndrome and can hurt us professionally. It's an interesting another example of, I think, what you were describing earlier as just the emotional labor of being the only woman in the room, and also just feeling not necessarily part of what's going on. Let's take some more calls. We're talking with Emily Chang about her new book, Brotopia, Breaking Up the Boys Club of Silicon Valley, where she describes what she sees as a toxic bro culture in Silicon Valley that shuts out women in one of the most powerful and lucrative industries in the world. If you want to join the conversation, have a question or comment for Emily Chang, call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, on Facebook, Twitter, or email us at forum@kqed.org. Sunny, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I'm Sunny from San Francisco, and I've been in the area for about 15 years or so. And I'm an electrical engineer, and right now I'm a product manager. And I have sisters, a couple of sisters. I have a wife who works in the tech industry as well. And what I haven't read the book, but what I want to say is, I think these are anomalies in my experience, and I've worked for different companies. I've never ever seen a gender bias in my career at all. And yes, there have been one-off instances where my wife, for example, you know, got approached by one of her co-workers in a weird way, and you know, it wasn't weird enough to go and complain. But these are really exceptional. You know, as long as you take some precautions against it, you're probably okay. I don't know, but in my experience, whenever you know, my friends have approached DHR. They've been extremely friendly and, you know, willing to work with them. And they've taken all these, you know, instances very, very seriously. So this pipeline problem that you actually say, I don't think it's an excuse, because the number of the number of jobs out there and the number of applicants, it's really based on merit, according to me. And if there are not number of women who are coming across to apply for these jobs, then it's really difficult for the companies. For example, Google is under a lot of fire for not being you know, well diversified in terms of workforce. So what I'm a little worried about is the pipes will open up, will loosen a little bit for women and be as tight as it is now for men. And that will accentuate the gender problem. If it'll sway in the other direction. And what it means is, to get into these jobs, you need to be extremely qualified and you need to be on top of your game. Right?
Well, Sunny, I think I'm getting your point. And I actually do want to let Emily Chang respond, because you said a number of things in your comment. But one of the first things, Emily, Sunny was saying was that he feels like these are anomalies. Are we making anomalies too big a thing?
I go back to the data. Women-led companies get 2% of funding. That is not the exception. That is the rule. And even if you look at just simply how investors perceive men and women, the research shows that if a man and a woman voice the exact same slideshow presentation, the man is more likely to get funding. And in fact, men get 52% of the money they ask for. Women get only 25% of the money they ask for. The same qualities that are viewed as positive in men are viewed as negative in women. So if a man is young, they say that's high potential. If a man is cautious, they say that's good. If a woman is young, they say she's inexperienced. If a woman is cautious, they say that's a risk factor. Another piece of data is the pay gap. The pay gap in Silicon Valley is 5 times the national average. So if you control for job title and experience and geographic location, the pay gap is about 5% nationwide. In Silicon Valley, it's 28.5%. These are numbers that you can't argue with. Just look at the data. This is an industry that loves data. And, you know, it's interesting, Melinda Gates, who is obviously the wife of Bill Gates and has now taken on this issue of women in computing, and she has a computer science and technical background herself, recently wrote an op-ed calling for more data. We don't know how much productivity is being lost because of discrimination, because of sexual harassment. So much of this is anecdotes, and it allows, you know, these stories to simply be dismissed. But I do believe that they are more than stories. They are more than one-offs. This is a systemic problem.
Well, Joe writes, the white male nerd prototype is not solely responsible for this dynamic. Every tech company has sales, marketing, and other non-tech roles. In fact, the vast majority of people at any technology company are non-technical. So let's acknowledge that it's a wider issue that extends far beyond the nerds. Do you want to respond to that?
It is a wider issue. Yes. Well, so if you look at a company like Google, they're about 30% overall. So that includes all roles. When you look at the technical roles, it's about 20% women. And those are really, you know, very prime jobs that are involved in sort of building the product. But even at the, you know, company-wide level, women are still vastly underrepresented. And by the way, I can't tell you how many times as I was researching this book, that people said to me, oh, Silicon Valley can't possibly be worse than Wall Street. Well, in fact, it is. On Wall Street, if you look at the top banks, they're pretty close to 50-50. They have a lot of work to do when it comes to women in leadership. But, you know, that is a far cry from the 25% that we see on average in technology.
Well, Jack says, being a Bay Area native and a male who grew up in Palo Alto, it makes me sad to see this new generation of tech workers not instill the values of the original movement that was more bohemian, hippie, and socialist. Let's hear next from Juliet in Petaluma. Hi, Juliet.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a mom. My daughter went into a tech high school wanting to be an engineer, wanting to build roller coasters. She ended up having to sort of argue her way into becoming head of a robotics team, the first girl ever to run a robotics team at this high school, when she went to the regional competition underwater mate program. She was the only girl leading a team that year. When she won third place, her teacher didn't want to announce it to the school because she didn't want to hurt the boys' feelings. That's what he told her. He said he didn't want to hurt the boys' feelings. And that started a three-year experience for my daughter while she watched other girls dropping out of the school at 2.5 times the boys' rate because they just weren't feeling like they were welcome there. Ultimately, she and another girl tried to run for an ASB a position, and because it's a Lord of the Flies sort of culture, it's a 65-35 girl-boy, boy-girl ratio, including the administration and teachers. When the boys started bullying and harassing, the girls had to go all the way up to the superintendent office, and they suggested that the girls maybe start their own club, like don't need to be in charge, let the boys be in charge. And ultimately, you know, my goal was really to help my daughter find a voice. That we reached out to the equal rights advocates in San Francisco who focus on gender equity, and they represented her for her senior year at this high school in hopes to teach her and them how to better position girls in technology.
Juliet, does she want to stay in engineering?
No, she's now in college. She got a full ride going into college for women and gender studies, and she wants to be a civil rights lawyer because she'd never felt welcome there.
Well, Juliet, thanks for sharing the story, but congrats to your daughter for her full ride. That's a big deal. You know, Emily Cheng, it's interesting. We're getting quite a few comments about how some of this happens in women-led companies. Teresa tweets, it's interesting that most of the comments defending the tech world are women, as it happens in many situations where women defend what confines them. What do you think about that?
You know, I interviewed 300 people for this book, and I came into it without an agenda. And I'm simply reporting what I saw. And, you know, I absolutely agree with some of your listeners that the education system has a lot to do and a lot to change. And there's a great book about what's happening in the education system when it comes to computer science called Unlocking the Clubhouse by Jane Margolis. There's also a lot of work that the industry can do. And I focus in the last chapter on solutions.
Yes, let's talk about
And a
about
company
them.
Called Slack, where the CEO is Stuart Butterfield, and he is doubling down on hiring and promoting women and people of underrepresented backgrounds. And he is completely of the mind that he cannot change who went to college 5 years ago, but there are a lot of things that he can change to encourage women to not just join Slack, but stay in the industry and have a longer tenure of experience that will enable them to succeed and be promoted in other jobs and perhaps become investors. And I think it's a great example that change needs to come from the top. CEOs need to lead on this issue, need to make it a 1, 2, or 3 priority. It can't be priority number 15. And simply by saying that he's looking for a more diverse workforce, asking for his employees to refer more diverse candidates, building more sort of structured review and feedback systems into the workplace, because in fact, how feedback is given, it can often also be very gendered. They've done a comprehensive pay review, and guess what? It's showing in the numbers. They have 43.5% women company-wide. It's not perfect, but it is far better than the industry average. And it just goes to show that it can be done with focus. And again, it is not just the right thing to do. It's the smart thing to do. I mean, Slack has a multi-billion-dollar valuation and is one of the, you know, sort of hottest companies on the block right now. And not only that, people really want to work there. They're really excited to work there. And so, you know, making this sort of his cause celebre has helped him attract some of the best talent in Silicon Valley.
Well, a listener says, hi, Emily, and thank you. I've been in the industry for 15 years and finally switched to retail. 88% women, but I miss the excitement. What's a girl to do? Let me see if I can squeeze in one last call from Dan in Santa Clara. Hi, Dan, very quickly, if you could.
Yes, very quickly. Well, I'm a little confused whether we should conflate or combine the venture capital world with the, let's say, more established Silicon Valley. For example, someone like Ellen Powell, I don't like her. She's Princeton, Harvard. She's an elite. You know, who, whether it's men or women getting all the money, that's those people are doing one thing and they're all jerks.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, the question is can you tease out the data between the
funders versus workers?
Startups, the bro culture of the startups with the more established companies? And that's what I'd like to see, because I guess what I'm saying is capitalism is as capitalism does. You don't get granted anything. They just take. That's how they make billions of dollars, and that's what it's about.
Emily Chang?
So women hold 25% of computing jobs across the industry, and young companies, you know, I understand your point about them being separate issues, but venture capital investors have huge influence on the companies that they fund from the very beginning. So I do think that the fact that venture capitalists are themselves male-dominated can also have an impact on company culture. And again, I just want to emphasize, this is an industry that can change. The people who are taking us to Mars and building self-driving cars can change this too.
Well, let me end with Christina's comment. I'm a woman working for a tech company in Silicon Valley. I feel fortunate that at my company, I feel respected and valued. However, I am underpaid. I could go to another company and get a pay bump, but one thing that keeps me where I am is not having to deal with bro culture. Emily Chang's book is Brotopia, Breaking Up the Boys Club of Silicon Valley. Thanks so much for talking with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Mina Kim. Another Hour Form is next. Stay with us.